whole birth of the middle classes and what, how the Industrial Revolution sort of brought about this whole, this completely new class. I mean, what was it about? What was it about the Industrial Revolution that gave birth to the middle class, would you say?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to say, you know, which way it goes, whether you put the cart before the horse, etc., because there's some senses in which it could be argued that a lot of the incentive for the Industrial Revolution arose because Britain had a much more flexible social structure than many of its European neighbors in the 18th century. And indeed, it was common in the 18th century to talk about the middling classes or the middling orders, the middling groups. These were the main sources of the new consumption. And it's in the course of the period really between the end of the French Revolution, the 1790s, and into the 1830s that that whole concept of the middle class is born. But it's really a recognition, a political recognition, a social statement of a group that had been there for some time, but it now had arrived as a prominent political force.
So were this a sort of nouveau riche? I mean, were these people, did they have any experience of spending money
yes.
And where did all that come, how did they deal with that?
Well, I do think that in the course of the 18th century, England is much more urbanized than most European countries. That's one really big difference. And the towns that are growing most rapidly are not the great metropolis like London. London is very important, becomes the world city, certainly. But it's also the growth of all these small and medium-sized towns right around the country, and the new commercial and industrial towns. And it's in that kind of urban environment that people begin to live in very different ways, and they start to aspire to more consumer goods, both to decorate their bodies, clothes are incredibly important, but also their houses. But this is following on from what the Dutch had done a whole century before. And so it is a sort of taking up of that urban environment and domestic environment, which is created, and the possibilities of living in that kind of way that hadn't been there and that in quite that way beforehand.
And who are these people?
Now they range. There's enormous a range. I mean, the middling classes in the 18th century, and then when they become the middle classes in the 19th century, they range from very small. They could range from small shopkeepers, retail traders in the traditional, very much the more the traditional trades. Some medical people, apothecaries, sort of really at the bottom rung. The professional classes, including the small clergy, teachers, etc., who are paid very little but still lived in a middle class lifestyle. And ranging up to the small scale industrialists, small producers, some of those smaller producers, ranging there into the great industrialists. And then we have at the very top level, of course, the great merchants and the great industrialists. They really led they led the way in what the very top, the upper middle class was at the time. And their lives were very much more like those of the gentry.
And how did middle class taste manifest itself? I mean, was it a new thing, or was it something?
Yes.
Were they taking it from the gentry, or was it something they were inventing themselves?
Well, I think there's a whole process of kind of self-invention really taking place over this period. There, it becomes much more apparent, much more political, and much more of a kind of social statement as we make that transition into the early 19th century. But before that time, it was, I think it is important to point out that These people in this whole section of the middling classes, they did want to, they did aspire to some of the ways of life of the gentry, certainly. And there was this code that was known at the time of politeness, and you dwelt within polite society or not, according to how you lived, in the sort of very strict codes of behavior, manners, dress, how you kept your house, how you were educated, all that sort of area. So that sort of politeness, and certainly as the century progressed and we get into the early 19th century, an aspiration to gentility. And so it's kind of a crossing over between the middling classes and, so, to some extent, the gentry, but just an aspiration to live this life that was polite and a life of gentility. And but along with that, there went a sense of, I think, a real self-identity, of aspiring to have things that were not what the gentry would have. So you would have things that were new and modern, that you were, marking yourself out as modern was very important. So where the gentry would hang on to, and the aristocracy hang on to sideboards covered with their the family plate and silver that had been gathered over the generations, and there were traditions of collecting this. And in fact, they had very traditional tastes. Many of them had very traditional tastes. The real trendsetters were to be found amongst the middling classes, the middle classes in the early 19th century. And they were looking out for novelty, the modern, new ways of living. They were looking for domestic spheres that were at first in the where the whole talk in the 18th century was about luxury, they move into a desire for convenience and then for comfort. So I think there's that real shift to aspirations, to innovation, a domestic innovation that demonstrated utility and convenience and also comfort.
Right. So, just to think about luxury for the minute, yes. I mean, how was it they would have seen luxury in the 18th century. I'm thinking particularly the stories about China. I mean, how earthenware would be plain earthenware, but then when printing comes along, the middle classes were able to afford, more elaborate earthenware. And the same goes, same's true for all the curtains and wallpaper and carpets. And that whole idea that suddenly this was available to the very rich.
There is a wonderful luxury debate right through the course of the 18th century that goes through all kinds of ups and downs. In the earlier part of the 18th century, luxury was considered to be something that had really negative connotations. It was corrupting. It was about excess. It was about ostentation. It was about the very rich separating themselves off from anyone else. But by the time we move into the middle of the 18th century, there is a definite sense that there is a good luxury. It has become a good, something to aspire after, that is about taste and aesthetics and convenience and having a tasteful lifestyle, which meant that you had a certain number of consumer goods, and those consumer goods demonstrated your good taste. And so we have that moving into the whole tenor of the debate in the middle of the 19th century. And it really is about the expansion of commerce and trade and the expansion of the new proliferation of a whole range of new consumer goods, which just hadn't been available before. And Chinaware, earthenware is a wonderful demonstration of all this, because this was, if you look at the family portraits, etc., that you see in the earlier part of the century, many of these depict scenes with intricate, beautiful sets of Chinese porcelain, hand-painted Chinese porcelain. But now, in the last half of the 18th century, the Staffordshire earthenware manufacturers are discovering that they can make some awfully beautiful stuff too, and sell it to a much broader range of the population, and that they develop techniques of making a fine creamware that they can develop, and they develop techniques for, instead of hand painting all these goods, that they find a way of transfer printing designs onto earthenware so that they can produce colored and patterned chinaware for a polite and cultivated lifestyle where people could socialize in all these intricate ways that they did in the 18th and then the 19th centuries, people coming in for tea, elaborate dinner parties, etc. And they could do that now, and it was affordable.
Right. Yeah. And was it, I mean, what other examples are there of the, you know, that kind of technology making things affordable?
Yes, I think this is a wonderful technology which develops, starts in the 18th century and becomes much more widespread, so that it becomes very much a part of domestic settings in the early 19th century, this Regency period that we're looking at here. We like to talk about the American system of manufactures, this great achievement that the Americans have in their technology. But I think we need to look at a very special kind of technological development and design development, which is started in England around the middle of the 18th century and widely developed across a whole range of consumer commodities from that. And that is the development of a cult of imitation. And it is a technology and a design style which was aspired after in the 18th century. This was not about blind copying, making cheap and nasty copies of fine Chinese porcelain or of the beautiful Japanese lacquer or fine silks, etc. It was about finding a way of producing something that was similar and could be used for in a similar purpose, and also show off all the design techniques you wanted to show off. But it was made in much cheaper materials by stamping and printing techniques which had recently become available, and that these could be applied across a wide range for producing a wide range of commodities. And they produced things that were similar, but they were different enough that they were modern novelties and they were really sought after. It wasn't just the middling classes that wanted Wedgwood tea and dinner services. It was also the gentry and the aristocracy. It wasn't just the middling classes that wanted Japaned ware in the early 19th century. Yes, they could have bought the most expensive Japanese lacquer, but instead there was all this wonderful Japaned ware, which was now, because of the technologies that had been developed in using it, it could be used on paper mache, on tin plate. You could produce any kind of decorative sort of item and Japan it. And so it wasn't just on wood, it wasn't just something that was about furniture. You could create a whole decor using these. And so there's this whole concept of imitation that I think we need to pursue. It brought in transfer printing. We see it in Japanning. We see it in the development of bone china in porcelain production. The calico printing, and which again, the techniques of that could be applied in so many ways, producing wallpaper, producing curtains, producing, of course, calico printed clothing, gowns, etc. But the printing processes are very similar. They start off with sort of copper plate printing. It goes off into the graphic arts as well.
Is this sort of Is this due to the coming of the machine or the way factory production is working? I mean, how come they can make things more affordable for everybody?
Well, I think it isn't just machines. And a good example of that is some of the examples that we have in this room. There's some Sheffield plate candlesticks. Mm. And Sheffield plate was one of the really wonderful advances of the mid-18th century. As you can imagine, everybody would need some candlesticks, and to have some very nice at least one set of something that looked like silver candlesticks was really important if you were maintaining any kind of middling class status. And so there was a big potential market out there to be grasped. And it was just this, it is a chemical process. It's a discovery of using materials differently, finding cheaper materials you can put together. Instead of having silver, use copper and fuse it with a thin veneer of silver. And it also created a material that it was easier to make more interesting decorative shapes out of, and a lot of the processes could then be much more easily extended because they could apply stamping and dye techniques which were being developed with the development of steel. There's all these things run in together, and using those materials brought more opportunities for more new things and new ways of decorating and decorating these objects.
And was it, what sounds interesting about it is that these were not undervalued by the... Mm-hmm.
That's right.
By the posh people.
Yes.
They were saying, well, these are all good things. These are all useful things. Axemen's to carpets.
Yes.
Are good because they could be made wide and...
That's right. You could make them to the width that you wanted. The Axminster carpets had a wonderful deep pile to them that you didn't get with the old Turkish Persian carpets that you see displayed in so many of those Dutch and earlier 18th century paintings. And the real luxury items, those carpets. But an Axminster carpet could be, it was woven by people at home, and an Axminster employed girls, not... highly skilled weavers, hand weavers, to do this. He employed young girls, and it was a factory product. But it was a factory product that not just the middle classes wanted. Everybody wanted to have these. It was comfortable, and you could apply all kinds of different designs, weave all sorts of different designs in it. So it was very vibrant and colorful and patterned.
What would happen before? Presumably you just bought whatever the Turks made. Is that right?
Yes,
that...
you had your wooden floors, and you put smaller pieces of carpeting onto them. If you were very wealthy, you had much larger pieces. But this is from these Axminster carpets are being produced. Certainly, the first ones are produced in the late 1750s, and they are being they become very popular in later years of the 18th century. So they are appearing much more widely. By the time we get to this period in the 1830s and then into the 1840s, we're really talking about Kidderminster and Brussels carpets, which don't have such a thick pile. But are much cheaper. The Axminster was the kind of luxury product, luxury end of the market, and they were actually produced in the Kidderminster carpets. The Brussels carpets were produced in Kidderminster. The Kidderminster carpets were produced in Scotland. So it all got a little confusing about the sources of what you were actually buying.
That's fascinating.
Yes.
Maybe you could tell me a bit about we talked a bit about earthenware. The sort of story of curtains. Why were people interested in patterns, for instance? Was that something new?
Yes.
Were patterns a new idea?
Yeah, I really think that we've lived for too long with a dull gray and black industrial revolution. The industrial revolution was really all about color and pattern. And people's aspiration, they just huge affinity to this sense, this sort of real color sense. And so we can look around this room, and this is the blue period of English history. And it's all about indigo. It's about the East India Company transferring, first of all, it had taken the sort of cultivation of indigo to its plantations in the Caribbean. But by the 1830s, they had taken that all back to Bengal. And this is Bengal indigo coming back into Britain. And so many of the so much of the carpeting, the wall coverings, it was the most popular color. And there was a huge, it was probably, I think it was the second most important export coming out of India in the 1830s and 1840s. Apart from raw cotton and
right. Well,
so,
what was difficult about India? I mean, why was indigo popular? Was it because it was difficult to make?
Well, it was
the
color was much richer and deeper than the traditional woad, which blue was taken from earlier in the natural blues that we had earlier, but indigo was much richer and a sort of much deeper color, and it was hugely popular. And it's not just that. We see the color coming, the reds, and certainly the 19th century, it's a sort of the yellow that comes in. There's sort of so many of these rooms, sort of vibrant yellows coming out. And also, so the dyes. It's actually the sort of, as a huge development of the dyeing industry. We still don't have very much success with chemical dyes for some time. Those are a later development, but still, the industry is expanding very rapidly, and it's a sort of major. This is a sort of major investment, a major area of development. It's a major aesthetic aspect. These colors. The patterns are another very interesting thing, because Europe was hit with printed calicoes at the end of the 17th century and the early 18th century. And it was like it had never seen anything like this before when the East India Company started to bring in printed calicoes on fine cotton. This was it was more aspired to for wealthy women to wear than the finest, virtually the finest silks. They were painted on, these calicoes, the patterns were painted on by hand in these Indian villages, but they were so cheap. The East India Company actually had to start they wanted to really create a market for this right down the way, and they had to actually sort of raise the price a little to get the sort of luxury end of the market. But it was just the vibrancy of the patterns and the colors. This was something that had not been available on this wide scale before, because they brought them in, they were really very inexpensive. It was what sold cotton. It wasn't cotton that people wanted to wear, it was prints. And to be able to wear those cheap prints, it was the real fashion fabric of the period.
The problem is, if you're talking about it being cheap, why do you need machines to make it later down the line? I mean,
because it was made in India. And what would the Indians buy of British goods? They wore British gold, adorning their bodies in British gold. They didn't need any British manufacturers. And if you were going to maintain what was conceived at the time to be the balance of trade and not lose everything you had, and gold flows out for luxury goods from Asia, well, then you had to stop buying the Asian things. And indeed, there were laws that were brought in to prevent the import of calicoes in the 18th century, the mid and later 18th century. The calicoes were banned. Printed calicoes from Asia and then from Europe, but the British had already started making their own. The big thing also about these prints was that the dyes were fixed, and it took a very long time before, and this would have been going on since virtually the 10th century in India, but the Europeans didn't know how to fix the dyes in their printed wares, and it took into the late 18th century before that was discovered.
And what was it, the way that we could print fabrics on machines, or anything, particularly the room next door, was that a sort of breakthrough that you could actually, you didn't have to hand color everything, you didn't have to paint the design on, with teams of people doing it.
Yes.
You could actually have a machine that did it.
Yes, well, it is interesting that our, one of our greatest entrepreneurs of the Industrial Revolution, Robert Peel, made his success on using what was really the Indian technology in this, which instead of using the European tradition of block printing, where you hired engravers, highly skilled engravers, to carve the design into the block and then print it onto the fabric, he discovered it was much cheaper to use great rooms of teenage girls to go back to demechanize, as it were, and have these girls painting the designs on by hand or hammering 10,000 pins into a block. Absolutely debilitating work, but they were so cheap compared to one skilled block engraver. But then he moves on from there to using first the copper plate printing, which is a technique which spans the arts as well as manufactures, and then those that copper plate technique is then transferred onto big roller drums, and we get the cylinder printing, which comes in the 1780s. And with that cylinder printing, it becomes possible to produce not just material for fashion fabrics, for dresses, but lots for upholstery and furnishings and curtains, and that you could produce great large pieces of it, and at a sort of fairly cheap price. So that even, you know, by this period of the early 1830s, it was quite common to cover your walls with printed fabric, not wallpapers. Right. The wallpapers are produced, mass-produced, after the 1840s.
Okay, good. I have a clip there that you'll
have some change of transfer.
Yeah. Very good.
Okay, that's also going to take. Okay.
Middle classes do all these fantastic goods that they were buying and bringing into the home?
Well, they created new domestic spaces, new ways of living that were very different from their ways of living in the 18th century, where life was much more public in the 18th century. There was much more going out and about on the street, the going to the public gardens, Vauxhall Gardens, very popular, etc. Eating out, that it was quite widespread practice for people down to the labouring poor, not to cook at home, but to go to the cook shop. It was just like the takeaway now. There were so many of these all over the place. We have to remember this very commercial society, even in the 18th century. So many shops, small chandlers all over the place in any of these urban settings. And I mean, gosh, there was a shop for every 50 people in the middle of the 18th century. This continues in a rather different way in the 19th century, and the home starts to become separated off from the rest, from the public parts of life, where people used to live in lodging houses or live in a set of rooms over the shop or right next door to the factory. They now start to move out to a cottage, maybe in a new housing development a few streets away, and eventually, certainly in the 1830s and 40s, into the new suburbs of these towns, like Edgbaston outside of Birmingham, the new suburban areas outside of Manchester. And it does become possible to create a very different kind of domestic setting in that framework. And so we have then the development of the classic middle-class home, with a series of public rooms, which were the actually private rooms, but they were there, one or two drawing rooms, a dining room, a study or library, and then there would be in a small house, two or three bedrooms, and a room for the servant, because you always had to have at least a servant, one servant, if you were to define yourself as middle class. Because all of this new stuff and these new ways of living, they just took an enormous amount of domestic labor. And to keep it all in some kind of order and cleanliness, etc., as well as to lead any kind of sociability, it required more than the work of one woman, and certainly the men weren't doing the work, what we would call housework now, but was not even, it was a servant who did this.
How many?